once again, it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, and broadcasting in Olympia, Washington at 87.9 FM, in Seattle, Washington, in Olympia at 91.3 FM, and in Mojo Radio in Point Arena, California on 87.9 FM. My name's the V-Man, and today on the program, we're going to be taking a look back at the 2 years of Operation Enduring Freedom, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. My guest, Professor Mark Harold, professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire and author of Blown Away, The Myth and Reality of Precision Bombing in Afghanistan. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat coming up straight ahead here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Even before the world focused on Afghanistan as a sanctuary for Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda terrorists, the country was on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe, the site of the greatest crisis in hunger and refugee displacement in the world. After a relentless 4-year drought and the total failure of the Taliban government to administer the needs of the country, 4 million people abandoned their homes in search of shelter and food in Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, and elsewhere, while those left behind fed on meals of locusts and animal fodder. In late 2001, U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan dramatically worsened the situation for Afghan civilians on the ground. U.S. forces were able to oust the Taliban leaders with about 3,000 fighters, but the hunt for Osama bin Laden and Taliban leader Mullah Omar proved more difficult than the Bush administration imagined. Suddenly, U.S. leaders were saying that the war in Afghanistan was to free the civilian population from the clutches of the evil warlords. Well, it's been 2 years since the war on terror was first embarked upon in Afghanistan. Has anything really changed for the Afghan people? A cursory glance at some recent news stories should lead one to believe that the situation in Afghanistan has worsened. Joining us today on Rockin' the Boat is Mark Harold, professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire and author of Blown Away, The Myth and Reality of Precision Bombing in Afghanistan. Professor Mark Harold independently conducted research into estimating the numbers of civilians killed in Afghanistan by the United States in Operation Enduring Freedom. Thanks for joining me today on Rockin' the Boat, Professor Harold.
It's my pleasure, Vinny.
It's great to have you here. Your initial study, released in December of 2001, just 2 months into the U.S. invasion, concluded that more than 3,500 civilians had been killed, an average of about 62 deaths per day. Well, tell us what led you to take up this macabre task and how you came to the conclusions you did.
Well, the direct answer to that is I was asked by a couple of folks out on your coast of the country to contribute a chapter to a book which was being put together at the end of October, November, and they'd asked me to write a chapter on the human cost of the bombing campaign, and I sort of reluctantly accepted doing that, knowing that I was getting into something huge and that this would be enormously time-consuming, but they convinced me to do it, and that's really when I began doing this compilation of, you know, trying to put together as accurately and reasonably as possible the count of civilian casualties in Afghanistan.
What sources did you use, and how were you able to tally up these figures?
I used three different kinds of sources. First of all, wire service reports. There were a lot of people, and there's a misconception in this country that, you know, nobody was on the ground and reporting. In fact, that's really not true. there were quite a few people on the ground in Afghanistan writing reports for the wire services, such as Reuters and Agence France-Presse, and Kathy Gannon, a wonderful Canadian reporter who'd been in Afghanistan for quite a while, filed these daily reports. They simply weren't picked up in this country. I mean, this just was not something deemed by the editors of major newspapers and TV hosts and so on as something interesting. Going along basically with the Pentagon and the State Department, which had you know, said very explicitly that civilian casualties were a no-no topic. First of all, you know, to get back, wire service reports, there were a lot, and one can get those on the Internet, various other places publish them, and so this was really available for those who wanted to look at it. Secondly, I relied upon newspaper reports. The British newspapers in particular did a really wonderful job. They had some of their, the Guardian and the Independent had some of their very best reporters in and outside Afghanistan who were reporting regularly. You know, groups of three or four reporters sort of scattered across Afghanistan in the border areas. But there were other reporters too. I mean, Pakistani newspapers and, you know, French newspapers, you know, many others. And the third source was the occasional report by non-governmental organizations. There was, for example, an Italian medical NGO, non-governmental organization called Emergency, had hospitals in two or three places and kept very, very detailed records of the casualties from the bombings, age of person, type of wound, place, time of the day, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all that was ultimately available on the Internet, and so I used that too.
Many of the so-called enemy combatants, as labeled by the United States, were coerced into fighting with the Taliban. So then I guess what constitutes a civilian if these were just ordinary Afghans fighting in this war?
Well, that's a really good point. You know, I think that my estimates are, and I'm pretty confident of this, somewhere in the order of 8,000 to 10,000 Taliban and their associates were killed as well. And, you know, I suspect that, you know, 75%, two-thirds, three-fourths maybe of these were people who were in one way or another coerced into fighting, or maybe that's high, maybe 50%. You know, people who had minimal training. And I think this is, again, something which needs to be underscored in any kind of account of the military story in Afghanistan, is that this was really not an army. I mean, this were a bunch of guys in Toyota pickup trucks, you know, and they had a few missiles. Most of them could not go higher than 9,000 to 10,000 feet. American planes were flying at 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 feet. I mean, this was an insignificant military force. They had some old Soviet tanks dating from the 1960s, and so on. This was a ragtag, you know, operation. This was not a military. Take the Air Force. They had about 20 sort of MiG Sukhoi fighter jets, which were sort of pieced together. They were flown by Pakistani pilots. They didn't know how to fly at night, and you know they never got off the ground. So this was a really ragtag army, and to you know proclaim as Mr. Rumsfeld and others did, you know, this great military victory against this kind of an opposition is really a joke.
Yeah, The U.S. Military, the Pentagon planners, they've cited faulty intelligence, imprecision of aerial bombing, and the selection of targets in civilian areas as reasons for so-called collateral damage. But I really think that the mood in this country after 9/11 was such that people were easily dismissed, this so-called collateral damage. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think that the military planners just said, you know, allowed for their pilots to go and just have, you know, indiscriminate bombing all across Afghanistan? Or was it, what were these three things I cited earlier sort of at fault?
Well, I think the first two you cited were minor factors. In some instances, I think they were the reason, but the vast bulk, well over 90%, 95% of the casualties, people who died at the point of impact of the explosion of a missile or bomb, was caused by something quite different. And it's actually something very simple, but it never gets spoken about in the mainstream American press, and that is that the military and political elites decided to bomb in what I call civilian-rich areas using bombs with enormous explosive force. So with, you know, error probabilities. I mean, there's not a, you will not hit exactly the target, but, you know, you'll hit within 20, 30, 40, 50 feet 50% of the time. And so in the book, which you mentioned before, I mean, I spend a fair amount of time looking at the very detailed accounts of, you know, the accuracy, the error probability, how far do you have to be, you know, 50% of the chance, 50% safe from, you know, being killed, or, you know, how close do you have to be to the point of impact where, you know, the person will be 100%, you know, will be killed 100%. So when you start dropping these kinds of projectiles with margins of error in terms of where they're going to hit in urban areas or in villages or in desert compounds and stuff, you're going to kill a lot of people. You know, and that's why we have, you know, somewhere in the order of 3,500 to 4,000 people who died at the point of impact of these projectiles. So it's, you know, it's proximity to points of impact of these bombs and missiles which caused this very, very high number of deaths. And, Vinny, if I could just say one other thing on that. You know, 3,500 people in Afghanistan, you know, to us, well, 3,500 maybe doesn't sound that much, but, you know, relative to the population of Afghanistan, that's a fairly large number, because Afghanistan has a population of, you know, 20 million. So to make it, you know, correspond to our population, you have to multiply that by 14. And, you know, then to, you know, to get a sense of, you know, what would this mean in the United States? I mean, we all talk about the 2,800 people at the World Trade Center. Well, I mean, 3,500 people times 14 is a lot more than 2,800. You know, if we want to play the numbers game, and I mean, I think they're, you know, 10 people is too much. One person is too much. You know, these are people who were leading, you know, trying to lead just their normal everyday lives and perished.
And this also says nothing to the aftermath of the bombing campaign and the you know, tons of depleted uranium strewn across Afghanistan that will be, you know, depleting the soil for, you know, a couple hundred thousand years to come. Can you talk about the, you know, how it is, how life is on the ground now in Afghanistan after so-called Operation Enduring Freedom? And there seems to be some stability, at least in Kabul, but as we're hearing, the rest of Afghanistan seems to be run by warlords. Give us a sense of what has happened in the intervening years.
Well, there's been, you know, there's been really a continuing war, you know, whatever one wants to call it, you know, a war against a foreign occupying force, a civil war, you know, whatever. But you know, combat has not ended. And, you know, just to go back to the early part of what you just said before, I mean, I don't want your listeners to think that, you know, the major destruction in Afghanistan has been caused by, you know, Operation Enduring Freedom and stuff. I mean, Operation Enduring Freedom was, you know, kind of the icing on the cake, if you want. I mean, this country had been at war for 22 years. And, in fact, the worst destruction in Afghanistan was really caused in the period of time 1990 to 1996 when the Taliban came to power, when the Mujahideen forces, who had been financed, supported, armed, and all the rest by the United States and Saudi Arabia and others, Pakistan, you know, were fighting each other. And by the way, they continued to fight each other. I mean, just in the last two or three days, two of these factions fought it out in the suburbs of the city of Mazar Sharif up in the north of Afghanistan, and well over 60 people died. So, you know, the fighting really continues. It continues amongst the different private armies, and it also continues between a clearly resurgent Taliban and company, as I like to put it, because, I mean, it really is Taliban plus Al-Qaeda plus a fairly important Mujahideen group called Hizb-e-Islami of Mr. Hekmatyar. You mentioned depleted uranium. Again, this is a really important thing. Back in Iraq, 1991, the estimates are that the United States in that intervention left somewhere in the order of 130 tons of depleted uranium in tiny, tiny micron-sized particles in the mostly desert areas of Iraq. Well, the numbers, and, you know, I've estimated this on the basis of the numbers of munitions, the types of munitions used, and that data, by the way, is available from the DOD. And, you know, the estimates for Afghanistan are somewhere in the order of 600 to 900 tons. You know, so that's four or five times as much as, you know, what was dispensed in Iraq. And, you know, we have heard and we continue to hear from veterans and others of the effects of depleted uranium in Iraq, the Gulf War syndrome, and all the rest.
You tuned into Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. My name is the V-Man. I'm joined by Professor Mark Harold, professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire, and he's author of the new book, Blown Away, The Myth and Reality of Precision Bombing in Afghanistan. Professor Harold, you mentioned the intervention in the 80s. Can you give us just a brief reminder about what was happening there? It seemed like it was a proxy war. The U.S. was funding the Mujahideen, and this there was sort of a blowback which led to the 9/11 attacks, as some have speculated. Just give us a sketch of what was going on in the 80s for people who may not be so keen on what happened.
Well, in the late 1970s, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Brzezinski under Carter, and associates, I mean not only Brzezinski, others, decided to de facto lay a trap for the Soviets in Afghanistan and to make Afghanistan the Soviets' Vietnam. And they really succeeded. The Soviets were lured into invading Afghanistan the late 70s with a very, very large force. The Soviets moved in with 150,000 troops. This is quite different from what, we see now. And even with 150,000 troops and air power and, all the rest, including a compliant government in Kabul, which they put there, 10 years of struggle, 9 years of struggle, they weren't able to prevail. And I think the same thing's going to happen here. But anyhow, so this occurred, and then the United States and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, and this is where Mr. bin Laden comes in, were supported and funded, and the war by the Mujahideen, the anti-Soviet war, began. There's, by the way, a wonderful book which talks about this, and it's a short book, eminently readable, by Rob Schultheis, and it's called Night Letters, Inside Wartime Afghanistan. It's a marvelous account, firsthand account, of what the fighting was like in the 1980s. In effect, the Soviets controlled the cities and a few bases here and there, and the countryside was controlled by the Mujahideen, which, by the way, is the same situation nowadays. The present Karzai government, if one even dares call it that, is probably better called a mayoralty during daytime, controls Kabul. And besides that, the countryside is, in many parts of Afghanistan, about half the country, really up for grabs. So this is a, in some ways, a repeat of, what happened before. Some people try to make the argument that it's different because you don't have a Pakistan which is really supporting and funding and, all the rest, the Taliban and al-Qaeda and so on. I don't accept that argument because there's an enormous stock of weapons which are in the border areas and on the Pakistani side and the Afghan side, and the problem is not a shortage of weapons.
It seems that the U.S. kind of needs the Taliban to be kind of resurgent in order to justify continued presence in the region. Do you agree with that sentiment?
That's a really interesting idea. Yes, I mean, that's around, and I think that one cuts two ways. I'm not quite sure how I feel on that one. I can see the argument for that. On the other hand, I think that were the Taliban and associates in some way or another to stage a comeback, this would be a terrible political military perceived as a terrible political military defeat. I mean, the U.S. has tried to put together a kind of over the last year or so, a front, an Islamic sort of reasonable Taliban front of there's a name to it, to the institution, the organization, but it just really hasn't had much success. So I just don't see how the United States can exit. There's no exit strategy at this time, and it just looks like this thing is going to grind on and on and on. And, of course, just like in Vietnam, what the U.S. policymakers are trying to do is to find proxy forces to do the fighting. And, you know, it's quite amazing what they have come up with. So, you know, we now hear that well over 1,000 Serb troops mm-hmm. are going to join U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now this is a very, very sensitive issue. I mean, these are 1,000 veterans, Serbian forces, of ferocious combat against Muslims in Bosnia and Kosovo, who are going to be brought to Afghanistan to fight Muslims.
Yeah.
And this shows you the desperation, I think, really, which exists in the Pentagon in terms of having the wherewithal to fight this and not suffer casualties. And I think the business of, you know, U.S. casualties, and there are some, and the enormous financial drain is something which, you know, is going to turn the tide, really. And the Taliban have been very clear as to how they're going to fight. They have said, I have the document in front of me here, it was published in the New York Times on September 12th, a wonderful article by David Rohde. Title of the article, Taliban Eyes Wearing Down the U.S. with Small Attacks. They're not going to concentrate their forces because they get wiped out by air power. So what you have is you have these small groups. They've now the vehicle of choice is now no more a Toyota van, but it's a motorcycle. Mm. They bought well over 1,000 motorcycles from the Gulf states and the and Pakistan, and you now have these small teams of motorcycle guys, and they stage these attacks across the country.
And
so
these are being characterized much like in Iraq as terrorist attacks. Yet, I kind of view it as sort of a struggle for national liberation. How do you see that?
Well, it's a resistance. It's a resistance against what, you know, many in Afghanistan, certainly not all, perceive as a foreign occupation. And, you know, so I think the, you know, who's a terrorist is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, the kind of people who the United States has propped up over time and continues to do so, people such as General Dostum and, you know, Field Marshal Fahim of the Northern Alliance and so on, if you look at those guys' human rights records, they're worse than the Taliban. I mean, these guys were just, these are world-class thugs. And, you know, so, you know, who's a terrorist and so on, I don't think it helps very much to use the T word, except, of course, when George Bush uses it, or at least used to use it in this country, he was basically able to silence opposition. But in terms of helping to understand a situation, the T word doesn't really help, as you point out.
One thing that can be said about the Taliban, however, is that during their reign in Afghanistan, they were able to pretty much reduce the high rate of opium and poppy production there, which we're seeing now, once again, Afghanistan leading the world in opium poppy production. What more can you tell us about that?
Yes, this year will be the largest crop ever, well over 4,000 tons. Last year was around 3,700 tons of heroin, a very, very large crop as well last year, the second highest ever. And I think this is just one more indication of, in some ways, the desperation in the country. I think, you know, most Afghans understand that poppy and ultimately heroin is not something which helps people of the world. On the other hand, given drought and with relatively little rainfall and water, poppy is a much superior crop to grow than wheat. Wheat requires water and irrigation. Poppy cultivation requires much less. So it's a sign of I think survival, and you know people are doing and growing what they can in order to make ends meet out in a you know a fairly desolate and desperate countryside. And again, as you pointed out earlier, I mean for about 3 to 4 years now. This year was better, but certainly the years before 1999 to 2002, you had terrible drought and very difficult situation in the countryside. And I think the growth of poppy is also poppy crops and so on is also a reflection of the lack of control and authority of the Karzai regime in Kabul.
You wrote a recent article entitled "Empty Hat," and you detail this lack of economic involvement from the world community. Is this another reason, do you think, maybe that people are turning to the heroin production?
Well, No, I don't. Because what I was talking about there is foreign investment in Afghanistan, and, foreign investment is going to, go into things like producing consumer goods and maybe assembling some consumer good type things and the like. I mean, that kind of stuff is really for the urban upper middle class, which is about 5% of Afghanistan. I mean, they're basically, most of the foreign investment is completely irrelevant to a society which is still 85% agricultural and rural. Foreign investment isn't going to go there. There's no market. There's no buying power. And, they'll go to the Kabuls and maybe to Jalalabad and Kandahar and so on. But foreign investors are not going to invest in an Afghanistan which is wrought by civil strife and bombs going off and fighting. Even in Kabul, within the last week, you had two of the private armies taking it out against each other with some deaths. A foreign investor is not going to do that. And if I could just say one other thing about the famous pipeline, there's been for many years now, of course, the talk about building a pipeline from Turkmenistan down through western, southern Afghanistan and into Pakistan. That's a real pipe dream because, you're going to need a million troops to guard the pipeline. A Chinese 107-millimeter rocket is a very effective destroyer of pipelines from five kilometers away. The pipeline is proposed to be built right through the provinces where most of the fighting is taking place. There's just no way on earth that this is going to be built. Nobody's going to finance that thing and take the risk.
We're nearing the end of the program, so I'll just ask you one final question. George Bush recently asked Congress to approve $87 billion in funds for rebuilding Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm reading headlines today that say that money, it seems like it's going to be approved by Congress. I haven't read the full story yet, but I just saw a brief headline right before the show. How much of that money is going to the bolstering of the military presence in the region, and how much of it is actually going to rebuild these two war-torn nations?
Excellent question. Let me just talk about the Afghan portion. And $12 billion out of the $87 billion is the Afghan portion. Of the $12 billion, $11.2 billion is going for occupation.
Wow.
And that means military, police, and et cetera, et cetera, right? And feeding the troops and, whatever, all that business. That means, $0.8 billion will be going to something we might call reconstruction. We mean highways and things of this sort. But let me just say something else on that. Let's go back to the $87 billion. So $87 billion, what this means, for example, for the neighboring city of yours, for San Jose, is the taxpayers of San Jose are going to be paying an additional $435 million. That's what they're going to have to cough up in terms of the $87 billion. There's this new study which just came out speaking about the cost of war for states and selected cities.
We're going to have to end it right there. I've been joined by Professor Mark Harold, professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire, author of the new book, Blown Away, The Myth and Reality of Precision Bombing in Afghanistan. Where can listeners find out more information about all this stuff?
Well, there's a website, www.cursor, just like a cursor, cursor.org. And if you go down on the right-hand side of that homepage, you'll get to a picture called Archivist. And just click on that, and there are somewhere in the order of 30 essays of mine dealing with all kinds of different aspects of this conflict, including depleted uranium and other kinds of things. That's a good place to start.
All right. Appreciate your time tonight, Professor Mark Harold, and thanks for joining me here on Rockin' the Boat.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Vinny. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that does it for us tonight here on Rockin' the Boat. Join me again tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 o'clock. I'll be back live in the studio with Peter and Meg Lumsdaine. They'll be headed to the Middle East in Iraq with the Christian Peacekeepers team. Stay tuned for that, and stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org.